Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Good afternoon, folks, and welcome to another edition of Talking Twilight Zone.
You open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination. And you're invited along. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be talking Twilight Zone.
Twilight Zone fans, my name is Lynn. I'll be your host for Talking Twilight Zone, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Bobby Neer and Robert. Hi, guys.
Hi. Hello.
Hello.
Unfortunately, Ken is no longer with us due to other pressing commitments, but we want to thank him for his insightful contributions as a co-host since Talking Twilight Zone began, and we wish him the very best in the future. Now, the episode we'll be discussing today is one that is considered by many to be a classic called The Eye of the Beholder. And I'll turn it over to Robert for the opening clip.
And now, Mr. Serling.
Suspended in time and space for a moment, your introduction to Miss Janet Tyler, who lives in a very private world of darkness. A universe whose dimensions are the size, thickness, length of the swath of bandages that cover her face. In a moment, we'll go back into this room. And also in a moment, we'll look under those bandages. Keeping in mind, of course, that we're not to be surprised by what we see. Because this isn't just a hospital. And this patient 307 is not just a woman. This happens to be the Twilight Zone. And Miss Janet Tyler, with you, is about to enter it.
Okay, thank you, Robert. And before I begin, I want to welcome Ed, Clan of Chatton, and guest number 4. Let's see, The Eye of the Beholder. Well, okay, that is the story of a woman named Janet Tyler, whose face is bandaged for almost the entire episode because she has just undergone her 11th and final surgery to make her hideously ugly face look normal to the rest of society. To give her a face that isn't so grotesque that children run screaming from her and people turn away in horror. All of her previous operations have failed, and this is the final attempt since the state only allows 11 surgeries, and if this one's unsuccessful, she's going to be sent to a village where she'll live out her days with others who suffer from her same affliction. Throughout the episode, we only hear her speaking to the doctors and nurses through her bandages, and we never see the faces of the doctors, nurses, or anyone else. Their faces are just shadowy figures in the darkness. She asks about the weather and wants to know if it was a beautiful day and if there were clouds in the sky. And the nurse answers her in kind of a matter-of-fact sort of way and says she thinks there were clouds, but she doesn't pay much attention to that sort of thing. And then Janet says to the nurse, well, I guess my face is pretty bad, isn't it? And the nurse says, oh, I've seen worse. Janet says she doesn't want to be beautiful like someone in a painting. She just wants people to stop turning away from her and screaming when they see her. And the doctor comes into the room, and he tries to comfort her, and he talks very compassionately to her. But he has to let her know that if the surgery is unsuccessful, she will be allowed to move into a special area just for people like her. Now, this gets Janet very upset because she says she's going to be segregated or imprisoned. She begins to scream that the state has no right to act as God and penalize someone for just an accident of birth. So she starts to lose control and demands that the bandages be removed. The doctor restrains her, and he finally agrees to remove them. Meanwhile, on the television in the hospital, the leader of the society is giving a speech about conformity, and the doctor starts to question him. He questions himself and says, beauty's only skin deep. You know, what is the rationality behind condemning people who are different? So finally, they go back to Janet's room, and they begin to remove the bandages. Now, he warns her that she'll be sedated if she becomes emotional at the outcome, and Janet promises she won't. So as each layer of bandages comes off, Janet sees more light coming through, and when they get to the last layer, everyone braces themselves, and her face is finally revealed. You then hear gasps of horror, and the scissors drop to the floor, and the doctor yells, "No change, no change at all." We then see a terrified Janet looking up at the doctor, and absolutely, stunningly beautiful blonde Janet looking up at the doctor. We then finally see the faces of everyone else, and their faces are hideously grotesque pig-like faces. Janet is completely distraught and runs out of the room. They catch her and try to calm her down by bringing in a man with her horrible affliction. This man is a stunningly gorgeous man who takes her hand and tells her it's okay and they'll live their lives out happily in a village among their own kind where she'll be loved and accepted. She then leaves with him as the pig people watch them walk away. Now, this episode is what The Twilight Zone is all about. Eerie, unpredictable, tense, and a fantastic surprise twist ending. Now, granted, I'm sure that most people had a suspicion the first time they ever saw this episode that something wasn't quite right with the other people's faces because they were always hidden. I know I did. I first saw it 35 or 40 years ago, but I was never expecting them to be so hideous and pig-like. I mean, I have to give the makeup people a ton of credit for their work on the story, as well as the brilliant camera work in hiding just about any indication whatsoever that these people, who sounded just like you and me, were anything but. I read in the Twilight Zone Companion that the makeup director, William Tuttle, had just finished working on the movie The Time Machine, and he created those creatures, the Morlocks, for that film, and he worked closely with the director to help keep the cost down for Eye of the Beholder, for the masks and the makeup, which would have been very expensive. Now, Donna Douglas plays Janet Tyler and speaks at the end, but the voice of the actress, Maxine Stewart, was dubbed in for the dialogue while she was under the bandages. Now, I don't know why they did that. I'm assuming it's because Douglas was such an unknown back then, but then, as we all know, she later rose to stardom playing Ellie Mae Clampett in the Beverly Hillbillies. But anyway, Rod Serling, you know, raises the question in his closing narration of what kind of world is it where ugliness is the norm and beauty is the deviation from that norm. It would not be a very pleasant one, that's for sure. But this episode, to me, is definitely 100% classic 5 rating. And that's how I feel. This is just one fabulous episode. So now I'm going to turn this over to Robert.
Thank you, Lynn. Yeah, this is one of my favorites as well of season 2. And you know, it pretty much comes down to, you know, a girl who's in hospital and just wants to fit into society. And it's great how Rod, with this story, shows how society of that time and how, you know, future society is set. When she tries to get herself to fit into that society, it just didn't work out for her. And then people that don't conform or are part of the society is cast out. I mean, we've experienced that in real life, especially during the 1940s. Germany, for particular, tried to have a madman try to create a race that didn't quite work out in that situation. And also a character like that in the show as well, which kind of gives you... It's nice because it kind of gives you clues about what the society is, not only just what the person trying to fit into the society, what the society itself is, which seems to be very dictatorial society. And I like how they had the two different people portraying one character. You have the one girl that Lynn mentioned that was doing the voicing, and you have Donna Douglas after the bandages are removed. I wonder who was in that bed. Was it Donna Douglas, or was it the woman doing the voice, or was it someone completely different in there?
You never really know who it is.
No, it is very curious of how they did that. And also the darkness itself during the time, you know, to hold what they look like until the very end, I think worked in the Twilight Zone favor. The story pretty much felt it was set in a parallel Earth, or it could have been a planet, it never is mentioned in the story, where pigs were the norm of the evolutionary scale, kind of like the Planet of the Apes. Whatever was the dominant creature on the planet was the one that pretty much grew up into adulthood. I give this pretty much a classic myself, because basically a classic don't necessarily mean that it's a perfect episode, but the only thing that I was wondering about is the time lapse on the situation, because you would think after a face operation, if anybody ever watches Nip and Tuck or some of these other shows, that there has to be some kind of scarring situation around the face and stuff. And when
right.
they took off the gauze, there was no marks whatsoever on the face, which kind of takes the realism out of it. It should have been at least something there to show that she was healing from the process. But, you know, there again, that's just a little minor thing. What was interesting, too, that Rod took this story with him when he formed Night Gallery. He used the bandage scene in the pilot for Night Gallery with Joan Crawford when she got her new set of eyes. Also, he used it for a story called The Different Ones, where it involved a disfigured teenage boy who is sent in a spaceship to a planet where the inhabitants look like him. So Rod reuses it again when he starts the Night Gallery. Also, this was remade in the 2000 Twilight Zone. I think that's the Ron with...
Forrest Whitaker.
Roy Kurt, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I was thinking of the Grateful Dead one, the 80s one, but no, it was the 2003.
Oh, yeah.
Molly Sims played the girl in
I interrupt you? Excuse me, Robert. Can I interrupt just to ask you a question?
Yeah.
Because I went to IMDb earlier today, and I was surprised to see that it was remade in the 80s. I never saw it.
I didn't know that
never
either.
Saw it. I'm wondering if you saw it. And the reason why I ask is because the people who posted there who did see it, there's only a handful of them, called it an absolute travesty and said it was nothing like the original. Did you ever see it?
Yeah, I did. I had the box set of the 2003 one.
Did they change anything in it? Is that what happened?
I think pretty much they went by the same situation on that. I guess just took the script and reworked it pretty much.
Everybody hated it.
Yeah, it didn't do that well. And
okay.
Not only that one, but there were some other ones that was carried over into the 85 and 2000.
Yeah, the After Hours was one of them with the mannequins. I thought that was terrible. Terrible.
And Night of the Meek in 1985 was carried over to that one as well, where Richard Mulligan, I think, played the Santa in that one. So
they did a terrible job on After Hours, so I was very disappointed.
Yeah, originally this was called The Private World of Darkness because they were feared of being sued. I guess there was something going on during that time that was using that same title. So that's why it was called Eye of the Beholder, but it was originally called The Private World of Darkness. So
but I do know why they changed it.
Depending on which edit you get, has one or the other on the show when it opens it up. I think it's kind of interesting, too, that the banjo scene has been used in The Simpsons, Futurama, Third Rock from the Sun. Also, going down to kids' show, SpongeBob SquarePants, it was used in an episode called The Two Faces of Squidward, where he's bandaged up and the bandages are removed and his face is good-looking in SpongeBob SquarePants one. So
obviously these shows are written by baby boomers who remember that episode.
Exactly.
Definitely. Also, Weird Science, the series, which was spin off the movie, episode 21 of that one, The Ugly Ones, is kind of a tribute to Twilight Zone in that one as well. But my clip I'm bringing today is from Buck Rogers, The 25th Century. Now, as people know, it ran two seasons. I think they killed the series when, in the second season, they moved Buck and Wilma off Earth and put them on a starship called The Searcher. Well, the last episode before it was canceled, the episode was called The Dorian Secret, where this girl takes sanctuary on the ship from her people. When Buck at the end confronts the persecutors, this is what happens.
How could this custom of wearing masks have led to this tragedy? What is this secret that you people refuse to talk about?
In centuries past, tens of thousands of our people were driven to suicide, unable to face the horrors of their mutancy. To save our race from extinction, It was decided that no Dorian would ever look upon the face of another Dorian or appear without his mask. But now, perhaps my son is right. Perhaps the time has come for us to find a new way to live with an ancient curse. Perhaps the Dorian secret exacts too high a price from those it was intended to protect. Show him! Show him what we are! I am your leader. Do as I command. Remove your masks. Now! Imagine. Imagine, Captain, what it is like to live in a world where every face you see is a mirror image of your own. Madness.
The book finds out the secret is that all the men and all the women look the same on the planet. That's why they had to wear masks and to distinguish themselves from each other and develop their personalities in that episode. So there again, like I said, one of the favorites of mine from season two, Twilight Zone. So with that, I'll go ahead and pass it on over to Bobby.
But, you know, I just want to say one other thing. You know, when Rod Serling in his original script, he was going to cast the doctors and the nurses as being completely unsympathetic and actually mean to her because of her looks, and then he decided against it because he thought if he did that, that it would be a total tip-off to the fact that, you know, they looked like grotesque people. You know, he just thought it would be a tip-off to the ending. And I thought that was interesting that they actually were compassionate, but originally he wanted them to be nasty to her.
Well, they let the dictator be nasty and the rest
that
of them be compassionate, yeah.
Exactly, the doctor was compassionate, right. Okay, Bobby, I'm sorry.
Where was House when you need him in this one, huh?
That's right.
Okay, thanks very much. You know, talking about this episode is easy because in all the years since it originally aired, I've never met anybody who didn't like it until today, and I'll explain that in a minute. I went to IMDb to see what the comments were about this episode, like I have been doing lately. And it gets, from the people who have voted there, a 9.1 rating out of 10. That's very unusual over there, where anything in over 9, you don't see that every day. I mean, ratings above 9 are usually reserved for things like The Godfather. So that's the most unusual to see that high a number. And, of course, I think there were 18 people who actually wrote reviews. And of the people who wrote reviews, to my surprise, two people did not like it. One gave it a 1 out of 10, and the reason given by both was because the surprise ending is not a surprise, because it's given away during the series. One said you had to be an idiot not to know that that's where it was headed, because you can't see the doctors, you can't see the nurses, the camera pulls away every time there's a chance to see them. And so that it's obvious. Well, I agree with that, but ironically enough, for me, that's what I like about it, because surprise endings are nice. Not all episodes have surprise endings, but I really get a kick out of it when a surprise ending is virtually given away during the story. It's so easy to see that you can't miss it, but you do miss it. That's what I like about that, because I was only 14 years old when I first saw this, but I had no idea that's what was going to happen. I might today, I don't know. So whereas these people resented it and went, well, so what's the big surprise? You know, we knew all along that there was something up here. Well, yeah, but I kind of get a kick out of it. You look at yourself and you say, God, how could I possibly have missed that? So that aspect of it really doesn't bother me. The other thing about this story is I think you have to consider on several different levels. You can look at it as a horror story, just a frightening, scary story, where you don't know what's going to happen, and all of a sudden they turn around and you see these grotesque faces. But also, you have to wonder if it isn't a political statement as well. And the one thing I really wish we could do today is to talk to the writer, because I would simply ask, what was your point in writing the story? Is there a message here? Were you just writing a horror story? Were you trying to say something? Now, I wouldn't say that, except you have this dictator coming on TV during the story who's telling about conformity and everybody doing what the state says to do. So it looks like a political statement. Now, you know, Rod Serling didn't write this. He adapted it for TV. I don't know what was changed, what he added into it, whether he added anything. You don't know. But there seems to be some kind of political statement there, maybe an anti-communist statement. It is 1961. It's the Kennedy administration. And a lot of that is in the news. So it could be people would look at that and say, well, yeah, I'm glad I live here and not in whatever country this happens to be. That may be the point of the entire episode. I don't know. And I guess every individual takes it one way or the other. As a horror story, if you look at it that way, it's extremely effective. Like The Howling Man, it also sets up this very eerie kind of atmosphere and very unsettling. Even before you see what's going on, and even if indeed you figured it out, it's just, you know, there's dark shadows everywhere. It's a hospital, and yet it doesn't look like a hospital. It looks like some institution somewhere. There's nothing comforting about it, and people are very abrupt, and they're acting the way you wouldn't expect to see people act in a hospital. So that's very unnerving right there, even before you know what's going on. And very effective. I think it's brilliantly filmed. There's no question about that. And I agree with Lynn about the masks that are used there, especially for almost 50 years ago. It's quite remarkable. I really enjoy not seeing these faces at the beginning, not just because of the surprise ending. And I've whined about this before on this show, and I probably will again in the future. The one thing I don't like about today's television, especially movies, is this business about, since special effects are at their highest level ever, and you can do just about anything with computers, and you can fool everybody, it's become so mundane it doesn't mean anything anymore. You don't get to use your imagination anymore. This causes you to use your imagination. You don't really know what they're going to look like. If you decided that the doctors and nurses are really the ugly ones, well, how bad is it going to be? And when at the end there they turn around, that doctor turns around, faces the camera, it's really jarring, because probably whatever you were thinking, it's even worse than you had imagined.
Said I wasn't expecting them to be that grotesque. I had no idea they were going to look like pigs.
So in order to do that, you have to keep it a secret, because you really want to jar them. You know, I'm sure there were geniuses in the audience who looked at it and said, hey, you're not fooling me. I know what's going on here. And that's fine, but did you really expect them to look that bad? I think people even figured it out were probably pretty shocked to see it look that horrifying. So as a horror story, it's very effective. And earlier today, I told Lynn a personal story, and I'll tell it again now. Like I said, I was 14 years old when I first saw this, and I used to watch it with my older sister. We both were big Twilight Zone fans. And if I remember correctly, I think it was on Friday nights, if I'm not mistaken, around 9 o'clock or 9:30 or something like that. And we watched it, and of course, as far as I know, I was completely fooled by how scared I was at 14. I don't remember. And we were very impressed with it. And we also had a next-door neighbor who also watched it. It was a young woman in her 20s. And she watched The Twilight Zone every week, too, but we did not all watch it together. And she lived there with her husband. They've been married just a few years. They didn't have any children yet. And he went away on a business trip. He happened to be away on a business trip on that for a couple of days at that time. And so the next day, as we often did, we went over to visit her. To say to her, boy, did you see that Twilight Zone episode last night? Wasn't that amazing? Wasn't that scary? And what we found was her sitting on the sofa in her living room, absolutely paralyzed. She looked like something horrible had happened. And at first we thought it was a joke, or we thought maybe she was sick or something happened to her husband. And the truth of the matter is, and I can't speak for the truth of this, this is what she told us, she was so terrified by this episode that she sat there the entire night, unable to even go upstairs to the bathroom. We both lived in the same kind of house, a two-level house. You had to go upstairs to the bathroom, about 15 steps at least, and she was absolutely terrified to even get off the sofa. She sat there all night long. She wouldn't get up until we had come over. If any of that is true, that's a scary story. To paralyze, she wasn't a kid. She was like 25, 26 years old, and she was so terrified by it, she couldn't even move. Now, I don't know whether that happened to anybody else in the country, and it might have. And I don't know what happened to me. I don't know whether I had nightmares or not. I really can't remember. It's been too many years. But so as a horror story, it really is extraordinarily effective and very, very scary. Now, I like it. I have nothing really bad to say about it, except for the ending. I don't quite understand the ending. What are we supposed to take from this ending? So the doctors recoil in horror because she's not any better. She still looks grotesque, at least in their world, whatever world that is. And what is going to be the answer? They bring in this drop-dead, good-looking guy to talk to her and tell her that there's a place where she can go where everybody looks like this, and everything will be fine there. She'll be with people of her own kind. And then it kind of ends with them walking down the hallway, and are we supposed to feel good about that? Because I don't. Because why would you feel good about that ending? The days of leper colonies, were lepers happy to be sent there out of society? In concentration camps in Germany, was everybody happy to be put there because they couldn't live in Germany? I mean, it seems to me that she's being cast off into, I don't care how pleasant it may be, then I find that to be a rather depressing ending. So I'm not really sure whether they intended to portray it that way. And I got to wonder if you could ever pull a stunt like that off today on TV with politically correct times that we live in. All we ever hear about is incorporating everybody in the society, no matter what color you are, no matter what religion you are, no matter what sexual orientation you are, you're going to be part of everything else, that you can do everything everybody else. And I applaud that. That's great. I don't think you can do this story today. I think that the networks would have rejected it, because they would have said, this is not an ending people want to see. And so if you really, really don't meet the standards of the state or that everybody else looks, you're going to be taken somewhere. Also, why wasn't she taken there earlier? She suffered so much from being so grotesque. Then you would think that up until now, somebody would have told her about this place, or she would have known, or the people in the hospital would have said to her, listen, you've had many operations we can do. There's somewhere you can go where you'll feel better. All of a sudden, this guy shows up out of nowhere. So I'm a little disturbed by that. I mean, I accept the story just as a horror story and as nice to be fooled like that. But I just have to wonder what the message is of the episode and why the particular ending. I want to ask both of you, Robert, what did you think of that ending? And what do you think was there a message in it? What was it?
Well, I think they were saying, or he was saying that pretty much, even if you don't fit in society and we send you somewhere else, you are still a part of that world. And they still are going to control you. They still are going to require things of you. It's just the fact that they got you aside somewhere else to where they don't look at you. And I think he was looking at society at the time. You got to remember, this was during the Kennedy administration,
right,
and Camelot, and
right,
fashion was going on with Jackie Kennedy,
right,
and all that stuff. So it was kind of a feel-good situation during that time, and I think that's what he was trying to show, you know, as a part of this story, that if you're not part of society, then we're going to set you aside.
So you were content with that ending? Is that a feel-good ending?
Well, like I said, what really could you do with that ending? It's just pretty much, you know, what, the two step out of the door and you get killed by a bunch of mobs at the end or something?
No.
I mean, you know.
Well, that's the only thing
yeah,
I could have seen other than that would be, you know, she was so ostracized that it was either you're so grotesque, and anyone that's as grotesque as you does not belong in the society, and you will either have to be killed.
Well, so is this a political statement in this story?
Lynn lost her. She's going to have to call back in, Bobby.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Do you think there was a political statement here?
It probably was. I think it's a mixture. I think it was a talk of society at the time, and the policies of maybe...
A lot of talk about communism back in those days.
Yeah, maybe it was the policy of Russia or the policy of other countries of how they treat their people then. I mean, that's why I brought up the thing about Germany and back in the 40s where... You know, we have the dictator in this one, kind of the Hitler-like dictator. Hitler was trying to make a perfect Aryan race, which, you know, and also we have the recent thing in Kosovo where, you know, you have ethnic cleansing back then. There you
okay.
are.
Welcome back.
No, basically, I was just basically saying that, you know, other than to, you know, send her out and have her shot, you know, so you are so grotesque, you cannot continue to be in the society, you must be destroyed. Other than that, I think he was saying, well, there's a place for everyone. It may not be here with the rest of us, but, and the guy even said to her at the end, the good-looking guy said, well, you know, we'll take you somewhere where you'll be with your own kind and you'll be loved. Letting her know that you're not just going there and, you know, you're just going to walk around and, you know, we're going to eat and sleep and everything together. You're going to have people who are like you and are going to care about you like family. So I
if
guess...
If you were her, would that you be content with that? You would be... That would be all right with you?
I would rather that than be killed, but I wouldn't be... I would still... would have wished that I could fit into the real society.
Was there an indication in this story that she was going to be disposed of? I don't remember that. Did they actually
No. I don't. Was there, Robert? I don't think so.
I don't think so. I think eventually along the lines that, you know, even in our society, people revolt after they have enough of something. And I think if this story was taken on further on, that possibly the people that were living wherever they were ostracized to an island or whatever on that planet, I think there will eventually be a war between the two factions. I mean, that's the inevitability of something like this. Yeah.
I also wonder, when I watched this episode, I know there's no time to get into this, it's only a 23-minute story, but was everybody there actually born looking like pigs, or were they made to look that way, or what?
You don't know.
That's why I mentioned the Planet of the Apes thing, because it seems like a natural evolution at that time. Who was the dominant species on the planet at the time?
I seem to remember a line in the original Planet of the Apes where one of the apes looked at Charlton Heston and said something that he was disgusting looking or hideous or something.
Yeah.
I think
it was something like that. Like that he didn't look like them.
She turned her face away as if she was getting nauseous looking at him.
Yeah, Zero was calling her blue eyes.
He says, "Oh, he's so ugly. He's so
hideous." Oh yeah, that's it. That's it, right? He's so ugly. That's the line. You're right.
Yeah. Like, oh my God, Charles has to be so ugly. Oh my God.
I want to bring up one other show too that somebody. I didn't think of this. Somebody mentioned it at IMDb. In a much lighter vein, the TV series The Munsters, where the girl in the family was beautiful.
Marilyn.
Isn't that right, Lynn?
Marilyn, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was beautiful, blonde, and she believed herself that she was ugly because she didn't look like the rest of her family. And, you know, it was crazy because she was the good-looking one, and they were the grotesque ones.
And she couldn't keep a boyfriend when they saw the rest of the family, is that right?
Yeah, well, a guy would come to the house to take her out on a date, and, you know, he was crazy about her because she was beautiful, and then he'd walk up to the house, and she'd open the door, and he'd see Herman standing behind her, Herman Munster, and he'd say, whoa, and he'd just run, and Marilyn turned around and say, oh, what is it about me? You know, why don't these boys want me? Every time they see me, and they say, oh, Marilyn, you can't help it, you know, you can't help it that you're not as attractive as the rest of us. And they would all run from her. She thought she was the bad one.
What was interesting is they spent two movies off of the Munsters. Munsters Go Home, and there was another one, too, where they go over to England.
Right.
And the thing was, Marilyn was played by a different actress in those two movies.
Right.
Pat and Priest played her in the series.
Pat Priest, yeah. Actually, there were two Marilyns. Pat Priest played her, and then there was another actress that played her, too. I don't know if it was before or after Pat. Pat's the one that played her the longest.
Mm-hmm.
But they were both beautiful blondes, you know, but there was always, oh, what's wrong with me? You know, I'm too ugly. Boys don't want me. The poor girl thought she was the one.
Well, getting back to the story, all I can say is I like it because, like I said, it's a lesson to be learned in a lot of things, and I think everybody can relate to it because no matter what you look like in the world, you're either not pretty enough, or you're too thin, or you're too fat, or you're too this, you do that. You never
right.
try to interrupt everybody else that you see around you, at least even in your own mind. And so it's
yeah.
interesting. People don't think. I mean, who's to say what beautiful is? We set our own standards. And, you know, if we could decide tomorrow that people like with pig-like faces are the way to go. Well, who knows? But it's interesting that Robert brought up, you know, that was at a time of the Kennedy administration and Jacqueline Kennedy and things like that. Yeah, that may play a part in it, too, that there was a message there, too. I wish I could ask the writer. I'd like to know what he was thinking.
It's pretty much acceptance in our society today as well as tolerance.
But conformity.
Think.
Everyone has to conform to a certain, you know, to a certain look, to a certain way. And, you know, I guess at the end, like, she may not have wanted to be cast out of the society she wanted to be in, but at least she realized that she was going somewhere where she could at least live and hopefully be happy among people who were like her, and they wouldn't judge her or turn her away screaming like they do in the normal society.
Well, I suppose that's true, but there is such a thing as freedom, too, and, you know, you want your personal freedom to be able to go where you want to go and not have to stay in one place because everybody else gets disgusted
right.
looking at you. So.
But my question is, why is she afraid? I mean, she knows what they look like. Why is there such a fear? Was the medicine, was the surgery, did it change her perspective? Of the
Good
people
question.
Because she's from that society, she knows what they look like. Why was she running away being afraid?
Oh, she wasn't afraid of them. She was distraught because there was no change, because she still looked the same as she did. Because remember, as soon as the last bandage came off, he yelled, "No change, no change at all." And everyone was like, "Oh my God." And she just grabbed her face and put her face in her hands, and she wanted to run away because she knew that she was going to be sent away. She wasn't scared of them. She was devastated that there was no change.
She was scared of her situation, yeah.
That's it, exactly. Mm-hmm. Our caller, Ed Clan of Chatton, he says, "Be no part of the world, deny the flesh, and walk in the spirit." Well, that makes sense. That makes
All
sense.
Right.
I'll
buy that. Right.
Deny the flesh and walk in the spirit, exactly.
Okay.
I was bringing up something, Bobby. You were talking about, you know, hiding in the shadows and giving a reveal later on in the episode. They've done that in Star Trek. They did it in Enterprise where there was one character that was running through the first season that was staying hidden. You can tell the outline that the person was either a Vulcan or a Romulan, but, you know, he stayed dark. Because it was like a temporal thing where he was from the future communicating with the villain in the past, so to say. And also when we had the thing with Tasha Yar in Star Trek Next Generation, where we get the reveal of Tasha Yar's mother being half-human, half-Romulan. So,
well, let me ask you this. Do you like that kind of thing, these kind of teasers, or would you prefer that they just kept it a secret all the way from the beginning?
I'd rather have the surprise and reveal, and I like where some of these series and movies, they do the reveal. Cloverfield, the movie that came out a few years ago, didn't reveal the monster as a whole. It revealed, you know, bits and pieces of it, but you never seen the whole thing.
Right.
So, yeah, I think that adds to the mystery of the story itself when they do something like that, because if you reveal right offhand, then that's one thing that's eliminated from the story. Yeah.
Right. It probably would have been an even bigger shock had they not shown these characters in the shadows, but it made up for it by the fact that they're about as ugly as you can get.
Exactly.
So,
well, you know, it's interesting because in season 5, and you know, we're a long ways from that, but in season 5, you know, Rod even touches on this this subject again, because there's an episode called Number 12 Looks Just Like You.
Oh, sure.
Where everyone in society is supposed to look not exactly the same, but they're all supposed to look like maybe about a dozen different faces, and they're all supposed to look alike, and one person doesn't want to conform, and it's almost the same type of situation. So he has touched on this a couple of times.
Well, I can only say one more thing. I don't think that you could get away with this today. Like I said, everybody's so sensitive about everything that if you did this story, you'd probably have pigs picketing outside the CBS after the show. To say, what's wrong with the way we look, anyway?
You have babe out there. Just
to say that pigs are ugly, that's a heck of a thing to say. I mean,
I think that's an insult to pigs, because I actually think pigs are kind of cute. These creatures look worse than pigs.
I don't think they would tolerate it, actually.
I
only think they look good when they're pork chops, that's about it. So.
Pigs are cute. Actually, they have pig noses, but the rest of the pig is much cuter than those
guys.
Oh,
yeah, they were really cute in this episode.
Pigs in space.
Pigs in space.
They were very
pigs are cute. These characters are not cute. They only have pig noses.
All righty.
I thought what was interesting about the Twilight Zone that they never did two-parter episodes where some of these stories that we've talked about where they could have added more to these stories and maybe make the two-parter. I was just curious. During that time, did they all stay like that? Was there any series that did continuations besides Star Trek? I know the original Star Trek did on a couple of stories.
I don't remember any series from this early, from the early 60s.
No, I don't.
For the late 50s, doing two-part stories. No, it was always self-contained. They just ended it right. I don't think they believed that the audience had enough patience for that. But they didn't want to wait another week to see the end of it. So
you're talking about the to be continued type stories,
mm-hmm.
part one, part two. I don't remember too many of them.
Yeah,
have been some, but they were few and far between. But
right, I don't think they had any confidence. Today they love doing it because they're always worried about whether you're going to come back the next week.
Oh yeah,
so they would be sorely tempted to do that here. They would be sorely tempted to say, come back next week and find out what's really going on here. So you know.
Sure, they throw in the cliffhanger, yeah.
Sure.
Well, yeah, I think this was absolutely a classic episode, one of the best ever, and, you know, I thought it was very unusual that Donna Douglas playing the character didn't do the actual voice, but from what I read in the Twilight Zone Companion, she was virtually an unknown, and they wanted someone who was a seasoned actress.
Maybe in real life she really talked like Ellie Mae. Maybe that was the problem.
Well, I think basically from the Twilight Zone Companion, what they're saying is that she was a virtual unknown, and they wanted a beauty, a true beauty, to play the unbandaged actress, but they wanted a seasoned actress to do the voice, you know, kind of like a somber
voice. That's kind of an insult to the woman who did the voice.
You can't be
the one on screen.
Maxine Stewart was still doing movies and television even way after. She might even still be alive because as of the printing of Twilight Zone Companion, which was only a few years ago, she was still doing movies and television. But they wanted a kind of a somber voice and someone who was a seasoned actress, but they wanted a true beauty that they knew, you know, would just stun everyone at the end. That's why they took Donna Douglas. I don't know what Maxine Stewart looked like, so it could have been an insult to her.
Well, that's
interesting.
That makes them guilty of the very thing they're kind of the story is about.
Yeah, like Maxine's got the voice.
Judging people on the basis of their looks, that's the same thing as the story's about. That's right.
Well, you got to remember how many movies and how many shows where singing was required, where the original actress had to lip sync.
We were just talking about that yesterday. We were watching
West Side Story. Yes, Natalie Wood did not do the singing in that. No,
she was singing, so they dubbed her voice in. Yeah, that's
right. She was there because she was pretty. That was about it.
Yeah, and that's what Donna Douglas was for. This is Shingles. I don't know what Maxine Stewart looks like, but that's kind of an insult saying, Maxine, you're not too good looking, but you can do the voice.
Yeah, if I was Maxine Stewart, I'd say, this is a heck of a thing. This is what the story is about. Now you're judging me. I'm not pretty enough. What is that all about? Kind of bizarre.
Oh, well.
Anyway, it's a classic. It's one of the best, obviously.
It is.
Why, nurse? Why shouldn't people be allowed to be different? Why?
Shh, doctor, be careful what you're talking about.
I know, treason.
Hi, everyone. This is Dave AC. Sorry I can't be with you live, but here's my audio report. Episode 42, Season 2, The Eye of the Beholder, aired November 11th, 1960, and it's a classic. It's a 5 out of 5 straight off the top. It absolutely still lives as a brilliant, brilliant episode. In fact, it's one of those episodes that really gains from the fact that it's done in the black and white era, because it gives it that very film noir look and the echoes of 1984. The way the camera was held, the unusual angles, the way that the faces are obscured is absolutely brilliant in building up the tension. And the actress, should I say actress? There were two actresses, but Maxine Stewart, the lady who played Janet Tyler under the bandages, absolutely a standout performance. Every bit of nerve-jangling fear, every bit of frustration, every bit of desperation came through in her acting. And so it was a completely well-crafted, well-executed, beautifully photographed episode with that really dramatic chase down the corridors towards the end when we get more of the reveal of just what is actually happening. Of course, there's a very large underlying message in all of this, but I'm not going to dwell on that. I'm sure people in the room will talk at that at some length. But just to say two things. One, it was a really, really good episode, possibly one of my top three episodes ever. May I just point out one little Doctor Who related piece of trivia in a way. It was unbelievably good to hear that the lady's name, or surname should I say, was Tyler. Because in a lot of science fiction shows that I watch, Doctor Who and Life on Mars, the main character's name is Tyler. Of course, it was Rose Tyler who travelled with the Doctor in the TARDIS, and it was Sam Tyler who went back in time in Life on Mars. Oh, and just one point. Who was the gentleman that came to her aid at the end? The man who she was going to go and live with in their society? Why, he was called Mr. Smith, which of course, as Robert will know, is one of the names used by the Doctor, Dr. John Smith. But this was Walter Smith. It really amused me watching that. But let me not take away from the actual story as a whole. Extremely well designed, beautifully composed and constructed. And the actress who played Maxine Stewart was fabulous in the role. And just one little more piece of trivia, and I'm sure somebody else has said it, that Donna Douglas, the actress we see in the end without the bandages, of course is best known for her role as Ellie Mae Clampett, daughter of Jed Clampett, in the Beverly Hillbillies. So that was nice to see as well. So I'll hand back to the room and say, yes, 5 out of 5. Bye all.
Mr. Tyler, we have a lovely village and wonderful people. I think you're going to like it where I'm going to take you. You'll be with your own kind. And in a little while, well, you'll be amazed how little a while. You'll feel a sense of great belonging. You'll feel a sense of being loved.
What we're going to be doing now, 2 weeks from now, of course, is Christmas Day. The 25th is Saturday, and that would be our next show, but we are not doing a show, obviously, on Christmas Day. But, Robert, why don't you tell them what we are going to do?
Yes, I went ahead and decided what would be pretty good to do is a Christmas episode that Rod did called Night of the Meek, and that's going to be reviewed later on down the road here in season 2, but I thought it'd be nice to do a commentary for the Christmas season coming up. So on that day, while we're all enjoying ham and being with relatives and friends and family, that a commentary for that will be uploaded on the day. So have something to look forward to.
You can listen to it before dinner, after dinner, in the morning dinner. Yeah.
Thanks very much for doing that. That's very great.
We appreciate that, yeah. And then we will be on a little hiatus. We will not be here for the next 2 weeks. Bobby and I are getting married, and our wedding day is January
8th. Oh, is that right? That's the first I heard about that.
I was going to tell you. I was going to tell you on the 7th. But
see, she's gonna drug you. Be like a Weekends at Bernie's. You know, they'll hold you up.
Well. That's the first time I heard of that. I'm a little scared now. I don't know.
There'll be somebody behind you saying, I do.
That could be it. It's probably going to have to be that way. Yeah, right.
But we are not going to be here on the 8th. Our next show will be on January 15th, and that will be another very good episode called Nick of Time, starring Patricia Breslin and William Shatner. So I'm looking forward to that, and I hope everyone else is too. So I want to wish everyone a very, very Merry Christmas and a very Happy New Year, and we will see you again on January 15th. But in the meantime, on Christmas Day, if you want to tune in to listen to Robert's commentary on Night of the Meek. So Merry Christmas, everybody.
Bye.
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, everybody.
Same to you. Bye-bye.